prophets. I've been going through the minor prophets, and we're going to continue that tonight. The book of Hosea will be the subject of our study tonight. Hosea is one of the longer books of the minor prophets, so we're not going to get it all done in one service. So we'll just take the first three chapters tonight and try to finish it up in a second study, Lord willing, when it's my turn next month. In every one of these prophets, they're just so rich with truth for us and lessons that they teach us. And Hosea is certainly no exception to that. Hosea says an awful lot about the duty and the obligation of being one of God's people. And that's something we'll certainly see in this first study of the book of Hosea, because he deals with the fact that there are a lot of God's people that's basically going to be expelled from his family. I know there's a lot of people that say, well, that can't happen. Well, it did happen. And God did it to Israel, and he told him he was going to do it, and he told him why. And Hosea's story will help us to see that. The way the story comes about to convey that message is a rather unique and unusual story. We have here a timeline of a section of Israel's history, Israel being the northern kingdom and Judah being the southern kingdom there. And this isn't the full span of their history, just a section long, sufficient enough section of time for us to squeeze in where Hosea fits. The first verse of Hosea's book, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Well, you can take those king names there and just highlight them on the diagram, see when they reigned, and then that tells you about the time that Hosea prophesied, the time of his work must have been a time that embraced the span of those other kings. And he comes with a message in particular about Israel, but he also deals some with Judah and some things that would happen with them. We've got the map up here to remind you, in that Mediterranean world over there, that's modern day Turkey up there, and this is Iraq over here and Iran, to kind of acquaint you where that would all be on a modern map. Egypt, we hear about those parts of the world all the time. Well, this is where Judah was back in that day, and that's where Israel was there in the north. I might also point out there was an Assyrian empire back over in this area that was sort of the world power of that particular day and time. In Hosea chapter 1, we find in verses 2 and 3, the setting of Hosea's story. He says, the beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. Now let's stop for just a moment and think about what God has asked Hosea to do. You need to go and you need to marry this woman that's going to be unfaithful, a wife of whoredoms. Now, there's been a lot of speculation, as I understand, by some commentators of whether or not Hosea literally did this in his life, or whether this is something that all happened in a vision in his mind. And because, you know, would God ask a man to marry someone like that, and all that kind of discussion you can imagine. And I'm not going to worry about that, because at the end of the day, whatever we say about that, we're still going to get the same practical message for you and I today out of Hosea's book. So let's just recognize that God asked Hosea to marry this woman who's going to be unfaithful to him. Why? Because Israel had been unfaithful to God. Israel had committed whoredom against God. And in what way? Well, God was to be their true God, their only God that they worshipped. But instead of only worshiping the true Father in heaven, they also worshiped many pagan idols, idols of the Canaanites and other gods of other nations that surrounded them. And in doing that, they were committing spiritual whoredom or spiritual adultery or spiritual fornication, in that they were spiritually being unfaithful to God. So God is going to have Hosea's marital life here sort of act out a story that represented what had been happening between he and Israel. And one of the things that we're going to see in the story of Hosea and his wife Gomer is that Gomer, being the type of person that she was, would go off and cheat on Hosea and be with other men, and Hosea would ultimately go and find her at an auction block and buy her back. Now, I know that's foreign to our thinking. The idea of going to an auction and buying a person seems immoral to us, but understand, we're dealing with a concept here of an indentured servitude, where somebody resolved their debts by being sold as a servant to someone else. And here Hosea has this woman that he's given his heart and his love to, and they've made a home together, and she betrays that love and forsakes him and cheats on him. Horrible. And to get her back, he goes and pays good money for her. And to me, that's one of the most beautiful allegories in Hosea's story, because that's precisely what God has done for you and I. We, like sheep, have gone astray. Isaiah 53 teaches us that. We've gone off after our own desires and our own devices. And God, not with something so shallow as money, but with the blood of His Son, came to the auction block and bought us back out of sin, out of our unfaithfulness to Him, and offers to make us His children. You see, that's what was happening with Israel. Israel betrayed God, and God said, "You're out." And that was a big theme in the book of Hosea. You're out. You'll no longer be my chosen people, but I'm going to give you a way back in. And that way back in, as a people, would be through Jesus Christ. By that I mean to say, somebody who would be a descendant of the people of Israel from Hosea's day, it's not that they would be excluded from God's love or God's kingdom. They could become a part of God's kingdom, but it wouldn't be because they were of the physical nation of Israel. The doorway back into the kingdom of God would be through Jesus Christ, whose blood bought them back, you see, and gave them the opportunity to be God's child. Okay, so let's read about this son then that was born. Jezreel is the name. He went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. Lord said, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while and I'll avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now this refers back to some things that had happened in Israel's history. The kings of that northern kingdom of Israel were all evil to one degree or another. But as you sifted through the whole lot, the best one you could find would arguably be King Jehu. He wasn't as deeply steeped in idolatry as a lot of the others were, but there were some things that he should have corrected that he didn't. So that's a historical character that he's bringing up, and this whole deal of the Valley of Jezreel, there's a lot of different ideas about what that's about as far as that specific location, but none of that's going to change our larger view of this passage. And I want to use this as an opportunity to show how we can effectively study these prophets without understanding every little jot and tittle that's written there. Let's suppose that I look at that passage and I decide that I cannot understand anything about that until I know exactly what the Valley of Jezreel is about. Well, just forget it, because I'll tell you there's several different ideas and several different possibilities, and I've studied a lot of them, and I'm not sure I fully understand that. But I don't have to understand that to get the big picture that's being taught here. And that big picture is that God is going to break the bow of Israel. That the birth of this child is symbolic of the fact that Israel is going to be defeated, just like there had been some battles in Israel's history where Israel was defeated. Well, Israel is going to be spiritually defeated and cast out. It's sort of like, I like to illustrate it this way when we're talking about studying the scriptures. If somebody wants to zero in on a phrase like that and say, but I can't understand that, I've got to understand that before I can move on from this passage. Think of trying to figure out what a forest looks like by walking up to one of the trees in the forest and ripping off some of the bark and putting that bark under a microscope. Now, if someone's giving you the job of mapping out that forest and you're sitting there studying the bark under a microscope, you're not going to come up with a map of the forest. Well, here we are trying to figure out the big picture of what Hosea is teaching. Now, I'm interested in the Valley of Jezreel and all that other stuff. I want to know more about it, and that's why I study that. That sort of thing intrigues me. But I don't have to be satisfied that I've got that figured out right down to the last stroke of the pen in order to get the idea that God is warning Israel, you people are in trouble. I will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. That's very clearly the big picture message that he gives. Now, someday in studying that passage and bringing it in with other passages, I'm able to figure out more about Jezreel. Hey, write it down and send it to me. You know, if we can figure that out, that's great. But in the meantime, we can at least get the general sense of what this passage is about. The next child that's born is Lo-Ruhamah. He says she conceived again and bare a daughter. And God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away, and I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, nor by horses, nor by horsemen. Now let's stop and get two main things here. Number one, he says, I'm done with Israel. No more mercy. They're out. Now, for anybody today that wants to say that those 10 tribes in the north are still God's chosen people, and yes, there are people today that want to say that, just read Hosea chapter 1 and it erases that idea. This modern premillennial concept that so many religions teach that hold the idea that God is going to physically restore the physical nation of Israel with all 12 tribes, including the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom here, and that they are going to still be God's chosen people because they're still God's chosen people. Go back and reread Hosea chapter 1 where he says, I'm not going to have mercy on them anymore. They'll no longer be my people. I'm going to bring them to an end. I'm going to cause them to cease, God said. So that one thing we notice here is a repeated warning to the house of Israel, you're done. You're out. You had your chance. You blew it. They as a nation would no longer be God's chosen people. What about the two tribes in the south, the southern kingdom? God said, I'm still going to show them mercy. I'm going to save them, but not with bow or sword or battle or horses or horsemen. You know, a lot of times when God would deliver his people in a time of strife or conflict, he would command them to send their armies out, and against seemingly insurmountable odds, their armies would fight and win. And so God would deliver them by means of normal battle. Well, in this case, the Assyrian Empire is about to come in and sweep through and take away Israel and carry them away captive, and they'll be destroyed as a nation, and no longer again would they exist as a nation. And at that same time, Assyria would threaten Judah. In fact, they came down and invaded Judah, surrounded Jerusalem. You can read about it in the historical books of the Old Testament. And what happened? Isaiah 37 and 2 Kings 19 records what took place there. When Assyria was attempting to overthrow Judah, God stepped in, and without anybody of Judah raising a sword, without anybody getting on a horse and charging anybody else, without any battle between men, God sent his angel in amongst the camp of the Assyrians and killed them by the tens of thousands. What's interesting is we have some commentary from secular history that sort of dances around this issue. This picture you see here is the Sennacherib prison. Sennacherib was the Assyrian king who brought this battle against Israel and then tried to overthrow Judah. And on this prism here, he makes written record. You might could see the little tiny writing there. He makes this written record wherein he boasts about his invasion of Israel and his invasion of Judah. And he talks about having that Judean king Hezekiah hemmed up in Jerusalem, just like an animal penned up where he couldn't get out. And he did. But what he doesn't tell you on the prism is that he turned tail and run. And he's not going to tell you that for obvious reasons. His pride is at stake. But that's what happened. He turned tail and run back to Assyria. And the reason he did was because God sent the angel of the Lord in to wipe out all his army all at once. That'll sort of take the wind out of your sails. That's what he's promising here in Hosea 1. He's saying, I'm going to have mercy on Judah. I'm going to deliver them, but not with sword and horsemen and all that. But it'd be done by the hand of God. What the prism does say, the Sennacherib prism does say, is that he went, he had Hezekiah hemmed in like an animal, and then he just says, then it went home. He doesn't say anything else about it. The next record in Assyrian history says Sennacherib was killed by his sons. So much for bragging about defeating the people of Judah. God defeated him and brought about his death. He saved Judah just as he foretold he would in Hosea 1. Then the next child is born, Lo-Ammi. Now when she had weaned Lo-ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call his name Lo-ammah, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Those 10 tribes in the north, are they God's chosen people today? What did Hosea say? You are not my people. You're out. At one time, they were a part of a privileged nation that they were God's chosen people just because of the family they were born into. No more. No more. Why? Well, God had made a covenant with them, and in this covenant, he said, I'll be your God and you'll be my people. But they broke that covenant. They broke the part where he said, I'll be your God. They changed that. They said, no longer is he our God, but we're going to go worship all these other gods. And so because they broke that covenant, that released the bonds of the covenant, and God was free to say, then you're not my people. If I'm not going to be your God, then you're not going to be my people. But now let's notice something. Right after saying, you will not be my people, then he comes and turns right around and says, yet the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people. There it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of the Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head. And they shall come up out of the land, and great shall be the day of Jezreel. Now wait a minute. He just said, you're going to cease. You'll not be my people. I'm not going to have mercy on you. I'm going to kick you out. All those things he said to say, you're done. And then he turns right around and says, but you're going to be my people. How do we reconcile all that? Well, it's really not hard at all when we turn and read what the New Testament says. This is teaching the spiritual restoration of Israel. And the Apostle Peter takes up this passage in Hosea, and he talks about it in 1 Peter 2, verse 9 and 10. He says to the church today, the children of God today, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, get this, a holy nation. You want to know what nation is God's chosen people today? The Lord's church. It's not, you're not a child of God by right of birth, physically, by being born into a physical nation or a race of people that gives you some special privilege that makes you God's child. Today you are a part of God's chosen people by being a part of the Lord's church. To the church, Peter said, you are a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praise of him that had called you out of darkness into the marvelous light. Now, when we get to that part right there, I just want you to know there's a lot of folks out there that say, well, what old David Earle is teaching is called replacement theology. He's saying that the church replaced Israel in God's plan, and that's just not true. Well, let's just see if it's not true. Did Hosea say Israel would be kicked out? Yes. Did he turn right around and say that they would again be God's people? Yes. So is it literally physical nation of Israel that would become God's people? Or is it the spiritual nation, the church? Let's see what Peter said. Which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Those are quotations from early in Hosea, some of which are Hosea 1, where we just read. I think one of the phrases there comes from Hosea chapter 2. So Peter took Hosea's prophecy that Israel would be restored, and he made that fulfilled and realized in the Lord's church today, which he calls God's holy nation. You know, this all adds up when you study in the New Testament that he's not a Jew which is one outwardly, but he's a Jew which is one inwardly of the heart. He's not Abraham's child, which is one physically, but he's Abraham's child, the one who has the faith of Abraham. You read passages like that in the New Testament, and it begins to click. You can be a child of God today. If you're a Christ, then you're Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise, the New Testament says. By becoming a child of God, by belonging to Christ, we become a part of the progeny or the offspring of Abraham. We become a part of the house of Israel. We become a part of God's chosen people, a holy nation. It's no longer the physical seed of Israel. It's no longer the physical nation. Now it's the spiritual nation. And we know that's the case because the Spirit inspired the Apostle Peter to take up Hosea's promise of Israel being restored and apply that to the church. A church that's inclusive of Gentiles, not just Israelites, but Gentiles like you and like me. And that shouldn't surprise us because the Old Testament prophets long foretold that there would come a day that the people of God would also include Gentiles. It's come to pass in the last days, he said in Isaiah chapter 2. And he talked about the mountain of the Lord's house being established at Jerusalem and it being exalted above the hills. And he said, all nations shall flow into it. All these different nations, all these different Gentile peoples like you and like me, coming in and being a part of what Galatians chapter 6 calls the Israel of God. I stand before you today in the sight of God as an Israelite. Not because of any bloodline I have, but because of the blood of Jesus Christ. And if you're a child of God today, then you're an Israelite as well. Chapter 2. Say to your brethren, my people, and your sisters, mercy is shown. Bring charges against your mother. Bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but she shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband. For then was it better with me than now. For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Here, God, in the course of Hosea 2, and we're not reading all the verses just enough to give you the idea, God is using Hosea's wife, Gomer, as a picture of Israel. And he's saying, her conduct in chasing off after these different lovers is just like what Israel did. And sooner or later, she's going to realize, you know, it was better when I was back at home with my husband. Just like there would be people of Israel who would realize, you know, it's better to be faithful with God. You know what you'll find when you read in the New Testament? You'll find people of Samaria who were distant descendants of the nation of Israel obeying the gospel and coming into the family of God today, part of the Lord's church. And they became, in that act, children of Abraham. Why? Because they could physically trace their lineage to him? No. But because by the blood of Christ, they could spiritually trace their legacy back to him, you see. And so it's just like he promised here that there would be some who would realize it's better with God. But what did the others do? God blessed Israel as a nation and they took all those physical blessings and prepared them for Baal. They worshipped all these different pagan idols in the Baalim panoply. That's Baalim is a plural name for all these different Baal gods that the Canaanites worshipped. And there was a lot of them, just like a lot of pagan religions today have multiple gods. So it was in their day. And they took all these physical blessings from God and gave them in sacrifice to these false gods and these idols. Hosea 2 and 16 says, it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that you will call me my husband and no longer call me my master. I've got the New King James up there. The King James uses the Hebrew words. It just turned into English pronunciation there. But I'm using the New King James because it shows you the meaning of those words. And this shows something significant. God is saying, when there is this restored Israel, when there is this new relationship, the new covenant, the church being God's people, in that we'll no longer be, he said, where God is just a mere master, but instead we would look to the Lord and say, my husband. What's the bride of Christ today? Anybody that's studied the New Testament much knows that the church is the bride of Christ. That's readily observable in New Testament scripture. So today the church is the bride of Christ, looks to the Lord and says, my husband. What the Lord is showing is there's a deepening of the relationship. There's a close relationship. It's not an aloof thing so that just because you were born in this, you happen to be born in this one particular nation, that made you a child of this God that you might or might not have a personal relationship with Now you got a personal relationship with your Father in heaven as a part of this new kingdom that he has. In Hosea 2 verse 19 and 20, he continues to describe this change when he said, I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. Just what I described with this new special nation of God's people, we would have a deep personal relationship with God. Because if you don't have that, you're not a part of the nation. You could be born in the nation of Israel and have no interest in God whatsoever. But you can't be born into the family of God and not be interested in Him, because being interested in God is required of somebody for them to hear the gospel and obey the gospel and be born into His family. So you see, today, somebody who's a spiritual Israelite has had an interest in God, or they never would have come to Him in the first place. Now, what about that obligation as God's child? I said Hosea is a lot about that obligation of God's child. What about it? He looked at Israel and he said, look how you've lived. You've taken all these blessings I've given you and you've turned them and used them for false worship. Now look what he asks of us. He asks of us a deeper personal relationship wherein we don't treat God that way. Hosea shows us that we have an obligation before God to not commit spiritual whoredom. To not take the blessings that He gives us and abuse those blessings and misuse them, but instead use them for God's glory as we enjoy that personal relationship with our Creator. Chapter 3. In verse 4, he said, the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king and without a prince and without a sacrifice, without an image, without an ephod, and without a teraphim. He's talking about different religious articles that they used in their worship. And as he describes them being cast off and cast out, which would happen when the Assyrians swept down there and overthrew them, carried them away as slaves, he's saying there are going to be a lot of generations here where you'll not have a king. And all your religious stuff is going to end. The sacrifices, that's all going to end. All those other things, the sacrifices, the ephod, the teraphim, all that had to do with priestly work. So essentially God is telling them, once you're cast out, you won't have a king and you won't have a priest. But look what else we find. In the book of Zechariah, he promises the coming of him who is both king and priest to replace that old system. Zechariah chapter 6 verse 12 says, speak unto him, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch, that's Christ, that's the Messiah. And he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord, even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. He's going to be a priest on his kingly throne, isn't he? That's what Zechariah foretold. So when God allowed the Assyrians to come in and wipe out Israel, Israel would be without king, they would be without priest, until Christ would come, who would be both king and priest, and by the preaching of the gospel, he would welcome them back into his family on his terms. They weren't going to serve idols and be a faithful child of God. They could serve the Son of God and be his child. And that'd be the only way. Then he goes on and says, afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Why does he say David their king here? Well, it goes back to what in biblical speak they refer to as the Davidic covenant. And here's the Davidic covenant. Back over in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God through Nathan the prophet promised David that one of his descendants would be raised up to rule on the throne. And he was talking about the Christ. And David, in his own writings in the Psalms, later takes up that promise and applies that to Christ. You'll find that in Psalms 89, Psalms 132, and other places in the Old Testament scriptures that promise is hinted at. So the Messiah, the expected Messiah, came to be called the branch. the scion of David, or the offshoot of David, the branch of David, meaning that he would be a descendant in David's family. He would come from David's family. He would be one of David's descendants. And so all throughout the Old Testament scripture and the Old Testament prophets, a lot of times when he would foretell the coming of the Messiah, he would refer to him as the branch of David, or the branch. So in a few places, he's actually symbolically named David. You'll find that name David symbolically applied to the Christ in the book of Jeremiah. You'll find it in the book of Ezekiel. Hosea isn't the only prophet of God to symbolically refer to Christ as David. And to a person of Israel who was well acquainted with these prophets, that made sense because Christ was to be a son of David. So when we go to the New Testament and we read the gospel record, we're introduced to Christ as the son of David. And that's important because of promises like this. So this is foretelling that when the children of Israel would come and return, like 1 Peter said happened with the church, when that would happen, what would we do? We would have the Messiah as our king, and we would fear him and his goodness in the latter days. You see, that's a foretelling of the coming New Testament era. Hosea looked long in the future, yearning for a time when Christ would come, and anybody of Israel who wanted to walk away from their idolatry or whatever it was they were doing and come and follow God could do that. Anybody of the nation of Judah who wanted to hear that gospel call and come and follow God could do that. Any Gentile who heard that same gospel message could come and follow God, for all nations would flow into this new spiritual kingdom. Anybody from anywhere could come and partake of the waters of life freely in God's revived, redefined, rebuilt Israel, the church. Let's use a diagram to try to represent this. In the Old Testament times, in Hosea's time, you had unfaithful Israel, and you had this theme that we see so often in the prophets. You had a faithful remnant. He'll talk about the remnant. And a lot of times he uses the word remnant. And that's what he's talking about in Hosea 1 when he talks about the people of Israel coming and the people of Judah and them being reunited. He's running that remnant theme of the faithful remnant being restored. That's the people that didn't bow to the knee to Baal. That's the people who didn't worship false idols. That's the people that held true to the prophets of God and what God guided them to teach. And what happened with unfaithful Israel? God told them through Hosea, not my people. You're going to be cast off. You come into God's family and you don't meet him on his terms, he will cast you off. Make no mistake about that. Well, what would happen in its place? By the gospel ministry, we would have the faithful remnant of Israel, a part of this new kingdom, and what else? All these faithful Gentiles would come in and occupy the Israel of God. So that the one who would be an Israelite today would not be that physical Israelite, but the one who is of the heart, who has the faith like the Abraham, who hears the message of God and trusts God and obediently responds. Acts 13 and 27 has been our closing passage for every study of the prophets, and I want to revisit that tonight. They that dwell in Jerusalem and their rulers, because they knew him not, nor yet the voices of the prophets which are read every Sabbath day, they have fulfilled them in condemning him. These people ignored the voices of the prophets. We don't want to do that. We don't want to make that mistake. We want to hear the voice of the prophets. What does the voice of Hosea say to us? Well, the part we've studied so far says God has bought you with the blood of his son. And he's made it possible for you to have this deep personal relationship with him. But he expects you to be true to that relationship. These people that have the notion that you can go out and commit spiritual whoredom and live whatever way you want to live, and God's still going to call you his child, and at the end of time you'll still be saved, they're not hearing the voice of the prophets. They're tuning out the voices of men like Hosea. And I'll tell you, there were pagans in Hosea's day that tuned it out too. And they suffered the wrath of God. But we're not going to tune out the voice of the prophets. We're going to heed that warning and recognize we are blessed to be able to have this relationship with God. And we're going to live true to that relationship. and own Him as our God as He has blessed us that we can be called His children. Are you living in that kind of relationship with God today? If you're not, we want to give you the opportunity to do that. If you're not a child of God this evening, we'd love to assist you in obeying the gospel. Or if you're a Christian and you need the prayers of the church to help you in your walk with God, we'd love to help you in that way. If we can help you in either way, please come have a seat on the front pew while we stand and sing.